And then we go live. So just a disclaimer in general is that this, I know some people who join us for Thursday night haven't joined us for other Shoe Room in the past, so you haven't heard my disclaimer, is that this goes up on YU Torah, and also that actually this particular shear I put on YouTube as well. The idea is that people who might miss a week, I want to make sure to give them a recording and that they have that experience. Because what we learned together, it's very important. If you want to finish a whole Masechta, if you miss a week, you got to catch up on that. Otherwise, you, frankly, don't complete a Masechta then. You know, you complete Masechta minus an Amud or so. So very good to have everyone with us. And what we're going to be picking up with tonight is from our discussion last week. Now, I know last week we left off. We really quickly threw in the concept of Shemitah. The concept of the idea that on the seventh year, in addition to leaving the land fallow and that the land does not work, there is also a new concept, maybe for some of us it wasn't new, called Shemitas Ksafim, that also money will return back to its original owner. So if there was a loan, if there was a loan that took place, well, guess what? The loan now is bottle, it is annulled, and the loved, the borrower, does not need to pay back the money. So last time when we learned the Gemara, we're on Gimel and Beis, we're on 3B, we went through what we call a shock of Ataria, a back and forth, a discussion. And in that discussion, we said, let's say there's a 10-year loan, and Shemitah, right? So if you have a 10-year loan, one of those years is going to be Shvius. One of those years is bound to be the seventh year. Mathematically, that's what has to happen. So even though we said, even though in the seventh year, the Malve, the collector, the lender is not coming to collect the loan, still, when he comes to collect it 10 years down the line, Shvius will have already taken effect and will not give him the ability to collect the loan anymore. That's the magic of Shemitah. And then what we learned was that, wait a minute, so in our Mishnah, remember in our Mishnah, we have two Adim Zomim. They say that instead of Reuven having to pay back within 10 years, Reuven has to pay back in 30 days. So we asked this, wait a second, if there's Shemitah, they shouldn't have to just pay the amount that Reuven would have paid, the defendant would have paid to extend his loan. Because they decreased the loan from 10 years to 30 days, Reuven has to pay the entire thing. He wouldn't have had to pay it all because of Shemitah. So then we said, wait a minute, nope, our Mishnah is the exception to the rule. In our Mishnah, the defendant, the person who took out the loan, he did one of two things. Either number one, he did a prosbul document, which those who stayed on a little later last time, Henry pointed out, there's a prosbul document. And that prosbul document basically means Moster Shorasa the Basedin. I give my documents of the loan to the Jewish court system. And so since I'm not the one collecting, they're the ones collecting. Therefore, I do not violate the prohibition of Lo Yigos. I have not harassed and tried to collect from the person borrowing from me. Rather, it's based in collecting. So that's a nice little loophole that Hillel instituted. But, and then there's another way around, which is if I take a collateral, then also, since I already collected a collateral, it's considered as if I collected the loan already. So then I'm not violating the prohibition of lo yigos when I go ahead and collect it after Shemitah 10 years later. That's what we learned last time. And I kind of call these parts of the Gemara freebies, because what we're about to do is an Ika Da'amri. And Ika Da'amri just means that you're going to see the same content in what we're about to read from last time, just the order of the conversation is a little bit different. So basically, you're going to get about 10 lines or so of Gemara. So if you understood what we did last time, this will fly by very easily. If you didn't understand what we did last time, well, here's a chance to pick up on it once again. It's pretty much the same material. So we are starting approximately 10 lines down from the top of Gimel Amud Beis. We are on 3B. If you're in the English, it's 3B. Gimel Amud Beis, if you are in the Gemara proper. And the last word in the line is Ika. Ika Da'amri. There's a different version of how this conversation went down. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Hamaves Chaveiro LeEsser Shanim. Someone who lends, Reuven lends to Shimon a sum of money for 10 years. Ein Shvius Misham Taso. Shvius will have no effect. You'll be able to collect that loan 10 years later. The opposite assertion of how the first version of this conversation went down. The first version was, Shvius takes effect no matter what. This version, the conversation begins with the assumption, which we will disprove later, that Shvius does not take effect if the 10th year is not a Shemitah year. Since the Malveh, the loaner, the lender is coming to collect in a year that's not Shvius, is not the 7th year, he's collecting 10 years later, not 7 years later, let's say it's beginning the cycle, then Shvius will have no effect. And Amar Rav Kahana, Rav Kahana says, and you know what's a good proof for this? How do we know that Shemitah is going to have no effect, that the lender will be able to collect the loan in the end of the day, even after the Shemitah year? Does anyone know what's a really great Taniyotic source for that? Our Mishnah. Instead of our Mishnah being the question last time, our Mishnah is going to be the proof. Amar Rav Kahana, Afana Nami Tanina. This is the Mishnah that we taught on Gimel Amud Aleph. Om din kama adam rotz li tev yu elef zuz biyado, bein li tev mikanvad lamed yom, u bein li tev mikanvad eser shanim. Because in our Mishnah, remember, in our Mishnah, the Edim Zomimin, they only have to pay however much somebody would be wanting to extend their loan from 30 days to 10 years. The assumption is that means that Shemitah doesn't take effect. Because if Shemitah took effect, Edom Zomim should have to pay the full sum of the money. Because by decreasing the loan from 10 years to 30 days, what they're doing is they're making the guy pay altogether. So we see our Mishnah is actually the proof that Shemitah will not take place, will not have no effect on collecting the loan 10 years from now. He just can't collect during that Shemitah year. But after the Shemitah, he would be able to collect. So our Mishnah is actually a proof that Shemitah would have no effect. Otherwise, Edom Zomim should be having to pay the full amount of money when they claim they decrease it from 10 years to 30 days. V'yamit Shvius Misham Taso Kulu Nami Bo Shlumele. The Edom Zomim should have to pay everything. So our Mishnah is the proof that Shemitah does not take effect. But Amar Rava, and this is how the conversation goes down a little differently. No, you misunderstood. What's going on? Our Mishnah is dealing with a case. Our Mishnah cannot be approved because our Mishnah is not the rule. Our Mishnah is actually the exception that proves the rule. It's the exception to the rule. Our Mishnah is where someone played a game. It's legitimate. Either he took a collateral or he gave his documents of the loan to Beis Din. He did a prosbol. Right? So he wrote the prosbol. And that's why Shemitah is not taking effect. It's not Hamav HaMashkon, was the source of the Beis Din, Eimash Shemitin. But that means we assume that if I do not utilize a prosbol, or if I do not take a collateral, then Shemitah will take effect no matter what year ultimately you come to collect it. Shemitah could be in the 7th year and you're coming 10 years down the line to collect. Shemitah will take effect. It will cancel the loan unless you either do a prosbol document with Beis Din or you take a collateral. That is the conclusion of the Gemara. And that ends our discussion of Shemitah. By the way, it is Tu B'Shvat right now. And one of the complaints I always hear people talking about is, we kind of take Tu B'Shvat and we make it, into kind of a almost superficial celebration about trees and flowers and such. But really, there's a lot of halachos that are involved in agricultural laws. And Shemitah and Shvius in the land is just one example of that. Zadie and then Judd.
Okay. What if the debtor, after the Shemitah year, acknowledges that he took the loan? Does that revive its collectability? But what I have in mind is in the common law, the English common law system, which we have in the U.S., a statute of limitations prevents the collection of a debt. However, if the debtor admits after the statute's run, admits the debt, then that starts the statute running all over again, and he could be sued on it.
So if I understand your question is, let's say the Malva is not following halacha scrupulously, and he decides, even after Shemitah, to collect the debt anyway, and now he's in possession of the money, or the whatever, the karka, maybe whatever the lien was.
What I'm saying is the debtor, after the seventh year, admits he took the loan, admits he never repaid it.
It would almost be like voluntary then that he, I mean, the loan was wiped out by Shemitah, right? So now if he's saying, well, I really did owe the money, I want to pay it, I suppose he could.
Not that he says he wants to pay it, just he admits that he borrowed the money.
Wrong. We don't think he didn't. We know he borrowed the money, but he does not. He's not obligated to pay it back. That money now belongs to the borrower. Whoever borrowed the money after the Shemitah year, he is within his full right to keep that money. It belongs to him. And by the way, there's really two things going on here. So there's a question. I was sharing it with Henry and Shul beforehand, and I'll try to deal with it very briefly because we have some stuff to cover. Which is, so wait a minute. I'll share the question later. We have to do another Gemara about Shemitah. Okay, so we have a little bit more information about Shemitah that I want to get to, and then I want to share some ideas from Rishonim and Achronim. I almost jumped the gun over there, but it might address your point. So let's look back in the Gemara, and we are up to the words of Amar Rav Yehuda. And we're going to elaborate just a little bit more on the idea of Shemitah and the idea of taking out loans in general. V'amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Ha'omer lechavera amanash lo tishmeteni shvias, shvias mishametes. So let's say I want to loan you money, but I also don't want to lose that money. I don't want Shemitah year to come, and then basically I just gave you a free gift that I'm never going to see that money ever again. So what will I say? I'll say, look, I know there's Shemitah, but between you and me, I'm stipulating that we're going to ignore Shemitah. Between you and me, forget that there's this thing called Shemitah. You still owe me the money afterwards. And if you agree to that stipulation, I'll give you the money. So what Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel says is that such a stipulation will not take effect. Now, why would such a stipulation not work? Generally, especially when it comes to the Jewish monetary law, I can make almost any tanai, any stipulation when lending money to somebody. So why would this stipulation not work? Lema kasavar Shmuel. So here's a very important Shas concept. You know, if you're taking notes, this is like an underline right over here. Lema kasavar Shmuel, masta mashakasa bataru, because what you're doing is you're trying to make a stipulation that is contravenes, it's in contradiction with what the Torah demands. If the Torah says that the money belongs to the borrower, and I want to stipulate, no, the money is still going to belong to me, the lender, my word versus God's word, you know, God's word trumps my word. So I can't make a stipulation that stipulates that a Torah law will not be effective. I cannot do that. It's not within my power. So if I'm going to say, between you and me, Shvius is not affecting this loan, I don't have the power to declare Shvius is not affecting this loan. Shemitah is going to happen. It's going to be mevatel the loan. It's going to cancel it out, and that's beyond my power. So that's what Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel says. Now here's the thing. There's another idea out there, another monetary principle we have to know, which is called onah. Onah means literally means to oppress somebody. For those who came to our Monday night class, a number of months ago, we talked about onas devarim, which is to oppress someone with words. It's really derived, the original onah that we think about that's more explicit in the Torah is onas mamon, which it basically means that if I sell you something, for more than a sixth of its worth, I try ripping you off, then that sale is considered a mekach tos, which means that it was bought under false pretenses, and therefore the entire sale never took effect. I get my money back, you get your item back. It was considered like it never happened. So that's just a little background before we see the next part. But Itmar, wait a minute, I see a contradiction in Shmuel, in Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel's logic. Ha'omer lecha aveira amnashi in lecha alayon. No, well, here's the thing. Let's say I want to willingly let you rip me off. You know, I don't care. The 1/6 extra, I'm willing to take it, whatever it might be. I'm willing to take that 1/6 extra. I'm willing to pay the ona amount, and I'll waive the ona. I'll let this business transaction take place. So Rav Omer, Yesho Alav Ona. Rav says there will still be Ona, but Shmuel Omer, Ainlo Alav Ona. Shmuel says, if you make a stipulation in this business deal to say, I'm going to waive Ona, I'm not worried about Ona. So that will take effect. So we have a contradiction here. Why is it when I say Shvius will not take effect on this loan, that stipulation doesn't work, but Shmuel is okay by me stipulating that Ona will not affect this loan? If I'm not allowed to be Masta Masha Kosuba Torah, if I can't stipulate something that contradicts the word of God, then why is it any better when it comes to Ona versus Shvius / Shemitah? That's the contradiction in Shmuel. So, Jenny, are you raising your hand?
Yeah, I think we have the exact same concept in American law too. Like, you can't make a contract against public policy, but like, if you do, and the person who is the quote victim of that chooses not to assert its rights, like, things go forward. But if the person who's trying to take advantage wanted to try to take advantage, they wouldn't be allowed to do it if it was challenged. So we're like in America, we're allowed to waive our rights to things, but people can't force things against public policy on us.
Seems
exactly the same.
Okay, very good. So that, I think this is what you're getting to. If I understand correctly, the distinction, Jenny, that you're suggesting is what the Gemara is about to say. There's a distinction between me declaring that the law of the Torah will not take effect versus you not taking advantage of what the Torah is granting. Is that what you meant?
Exactly.
Excellent. Perfect. So that's the next step in the Gemara. Ha'itmar Allah Amar Rav, Ravanan L'didi Mefar Shale, Minei D'Shmuel, Amanash She'en L'cha Alay Ona, Ein Lo Alav Ona. When you say that you will not impose the laws upon me. What was the formulation used, Jenny? You won't seek your rights, or you won't press your rights. What was the formulation used?
I forget exactly how I said it, but I said you waived your rights.
You waived your rights.
It's not really waiver. It's if you choose not to enforce them.
Right. Okay, exactly. So if you're choosing to waive it or not to enforce it, then it's legitimate. Then ain lo alav ona. But Amanash Ein Bo Ona, if you want to stipulate that there is no such thing as Ona as far as this sale is taking place, Hareish Bo Ona, there's still going to be Ona, because then you're trying to declare that Ona doesn't exist here, but meanwhile God is saying it exists. And Hachinami, now we can understand his statement vis-a-vis Shvius as well. Amanash Lo Tishmeteni Bashvius, that you will not take advantage of Shemitah during Shvius, that you will not take advantage of God waiving the loan, and Shvius Misham Tasa, and then Shvius will not affect this loan. You'll still have to pay back. But Amanash Lo Tishmetani Shvius, but that Shvius, if I want to stipulate Shvius will not take an effect against the Torah, then Shvius Misham Tasa. The Torah says, God's thoughts are not the same as man's, and God's thoughts take precedence and priority over our own. That is the distinction that the Gemara makes. And again, I'm always glad that we have a number of lawyers that are on here. So it seems that this concept resonates also in American law as well. Okay. So I wanted to ask a question based on this. It's not really my question. It's a question of pretty much a number of Rishonim and Achronim. So here's the thing. Remember how we said that if you want to circumvent Shemitah, Hillel had to institute this thing called a prosbul, a special document that lets you circumvent the loan being canceled by Shemitah? Well, why did Hillel need to make this whole takana, this whole new innovation of a prosbul document? Meanwhile, didn't we just learn the Gemara here? That if I say, Almanas shalotish mateni bashvias, that you will not take advantage of the loan being terminated by shvias, I could still collect from you. So why do I need a prosbul? Every time I loan to somebody and I'm afraid that Shemitah is going to come along and cancel the loan, all I need to do is make this very short stipulation at the beginning of the loan that you will not press your rights of shvias against me. And that way I can collect the loan. Why do I need to go out of my way to sign a prosbul document? Why did Hillel need to go out of his way to make a whole takana based on this Gemara? That's the question of the Welt. The world asks the question. Everyone says it. So is anyone else bothered by that question? Does anyone have a possible teretz, an answer to that question? Or does the question not make sense and I could clarify it better? I'm happy to clarify if it wasn't clear. Okay. Well, if no one
you're asking, why is a prosbul necessary? Is that what the question is?
Absolutely. All I need to do, if I don't want shvias to take effect, David, if I were to loan to you, all I need to say is, David, I'm not shlotish mateni bashvias. I'm loaning to you on condition that you will not take advantage of shvias and that you will pay me back in the end of the day. Boom, done. No need for any special documents. No need for Beis Din getting involved. So there was already recourse on a Doraisa level. We didn't need Hillel to come along and make this innovation to help me. All I need is those few words. That's it. That's all I need to say. That's the question. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but it seems that even that gets in the way. You know, it would. If I knew that someone was going to take advantage of me, or, you know, was the possibility of taking advantage of me, why would I enter that agreement? And it could go past over Shemitah year. Why would I enter that agreement?
Very good. So I think your answer is offered by the Bechor Shor, if I'm not mistaken. So the Bechor Shor says that the advantage of the prosbul is that I could actually go after the fact with the documents, come to Beis Din, sign the prosbul. And because let's say, you know, it's kind of to say to you on condition you won't take advantage of shvias, it almost shows that I'm not trusting of you to pay me back, that I have to make this explicit stipulation. So one of the answers is a prosbul is a more subtle way that after I'm done with the transaction in a non-confrontational manner, I could then go to Beis Din, sign the prosbul, and that will guarantee that I could take the money back in the end of the day. I mean, it's a little difficult for me to understand because I'm going out of my way to do you a chesed of loaning to you when you're in need. I mean, it's not the craziest thing to expect for you to pay me back at some point down the line. So I don't fully understand that. But let me share just a few terutzim, a few answers that are found in the Rishonim and Achronim. One answer that the Ramban gives is shlo tishtacheach toras shvias. Because if I could circumvent shvias by just making this quick little stipulation each and every time, we're going to forget that there's a whole thing called shvias altogether. So by having to go out of my way to write a prosbul document and to make this entire thing in order to circumvent shvias, while I'm doing that, I'm at least remembering that there's something called shvias. For instance, think about, it's almost like what we do in Mechiras Chametz. You know, the fact that I have to go through this entire documentation, this entire process to sell my chametz, you know, it pretty much guarantees I'm not forgetting that I'm really supposed to be getting rid of it if I can. So I'm not going to forget that that's the right institution. So that's one reason he gives. The second reason that he gives is just based on human nature. I might loan you money, and b'shas maisa, while I'm loaning you the money, I might forget to make that subtle little stipulation to append that to our agreement. And if I forget to make that stipulation, that's it. I can't go back afterwards. Shvias will be mishamated, and that's it. I'm not going to ever see that money ever again. So by instituting a pros bowl, that guarantees that I'll have that recourse to collect the money in the end of the day. And so there's like a whole number of answers, actually. There's like nine different answers that I've seen over here. But one more I want to share is found in the Chidushei Harim, which is he bases it on the Rush. So it's interesting. There's really two things going on here. I've been conflating two principles until now. There's the principle of Shemitah. Shemitah says no matter what happens, the money in the seventh year now doesn't have to be paid back. It belongs to the borrower. It belongs to the loveh. But then there's another mitzvah, an isser called lo yigos, which is a prohibition for the lender to harass the borrower in an attempt to collect the money from him. So what is making this condition solve? When I make this condition with you, these are his words. Lefiz zeh yesh lo mar shetnai amanash lo tishmatini bashvias mo rak lenin hadinim hamamonim shachov lo yishamet. When I make this condition that shvias will not take effect or you won't utilize shvias, that only solves that shvias will not put the money in the loveh's possession for good. But that doesn't circumvent my isser as the mav, as the loaner, as the lender, to go ahead and harass the guy to collect it. My stipulation will be to no avail on that. If not for the pros bowl, I might be able to, from a monetary perspective, collect that money, but I would be violating a prohibition in the Torah of trying to force the guy to pay me back. I'd be violating lo yigo still. Until came along Hillel, the Hiskin Prosbol. Hillel came along and instituted this Prosbol document that says, even as far as the Isser of lo yigos goes, I'm not violating it. Why? Because I'm not collecting. Beis Din is the one collecting. Therefore, not only am I allowed to have the money, but also I'm not violating the prohibition of lo yigos at the same time. And that is a really great answer over there, I thought at least. Any thoughts on that before we go forward? Any thoughts?
Good.
We're all just floored by the fiduciary.
This in writing, particularly if it's a loan over many years, so that you don't have parties claiming that different things happened. I mean, right?
Oh, wait, what was the question, Jenny? Or is it?
I was just going to say, I would think that it makes sense to have that kind of a thing in writing as well, so that the parties couldn't later, 10 years down the line, you know, both claim that different things happened, right? One says, oh, I said it. The other one says, like, the person didn't say it. I mean, what about that just human nature explanation?
Ah, very good. And that's literally the next Gemara we're going to do talking about lending with a shtar. So good. You know, we set this up already that you keep bringing points on, I'll lead to the next Gemara. This is good. Right? We set this up beforehand. All right. So let's move on to the next Gemara. Tana. Hamava eschavero stam, eino rashai letovo pachos milamed yom. So here's the thing. Let's say I just loan you money. So, but I don't stipulate how long the loan will be. I don't say whether it's 10 years. I don't say whether it's 1 year. I don't say whether it's 3 months, whether it's one quarter. I don't specify. So what do we assume is the stam, is the assumed standard length of a loan? We assume it's 30 days. And this is something that we actually see in halacha a lot. If someone says, I'm going to be a nazir, I'm going to abstain from wine, I'm not going to become tamei mes, I'm not going to become impure by coming in contact with a dead person, I'm becoming a nazir, we also assume that a standard vow of naziris also is 30 days. But we'll talk about where the source comes from. Now, when we say that a standard loan is only 30 days, what kind of loan are we talking about? So we have two opinions. We only say that a standard loan is a minimum of 30 days when they wrote a shtar, when they made sure to write the document. Now, what's the advantage of writing a shtar of a document in addition to what Jenny pointed out about having a written proof of the loan? In addition to it, we have a principle that no one is going to go out of their way to write up a whole document, to have witnesses sign on it for a loan that's less than 30 days. It's just not worth the inconvenience of drafting an entire document if a loan is going to be collectible by the time the document's being done written. I mean, not literally, but you know what I mean. Avamilva alpelo. But if I just verbally loan you something and I say, look, it's between me and you, between friends, and then I come the next day and I want to collect it, In theory, if I wanted to be that guy, I could do that. I could come the next day and I could collect the loan because there was no specified
amount.
That is opinion number one. But the second opinion actually says no. Even when it comes to a verbal agreement, you can't just be, you know, you can't be a jerk and come the next day and say, all right, I'm here to collect the loan. If someone needed a loan, chances are they need more than one day to get the money to then pay you back afterwards. Amar le Rav, Hogi Amar Chavivi, Echad Hamava Bishtar, Echad Hamava Al Peh. It makes no difference whether it was verbal agreement, whether it was a documented agreement. A Stam loan is 30 days. And Tani Nami Hogi, and you know what? I can induce a proof from a Brisa. I have precedent for this. What's my precedent? Here's the Brisa, Tani Inik source. Amal es Chavero Stam, Ein Rosh Hayatova Pachos Mishloshim Yom. There's no distinction whether it's a verbal agreement or a documented agreement. A stam, standard loan with no specified end date, terminates 30 days later, and that is when the borrower will have to pay back. That's when the malva is permitted to start collecting it. That's the end of that piece of the Gemara. Now, there is one little continuation to it. Amar le Shmuel le Rav, Rav Masna, lo teisiv achroich ad mefarshus la lahosh maisa. Don't sit down until you explain this to me, because you know what? I hear this whole Gemara, but what's the proof? Minah ha-milsa da amar rabon ha-mavis ha-milas chavir v'stam in rishai tova pochus milam et yom echra mavis sharp echra mavis peh. What's the proof in this brisa? What's the proof? That's 30 days. 30 days sounds like an arbitrary amount. Again, why couldn't it be 3 months? Why couldn't a standard loan be a year? Where do we get 30 days from? Where else in halacha can we draw an analogy that we could say that 30 days is a significant amount of time? I would have thought maybe a stam loan should be a year. So Marlay, the siv, korvashnas hasheva shnas hashmita. If you look in the verse, so this is Bez on the side. This is in Devarim Tesvav Test. This is in Deuteronomy 15:9. It says the words Korva Shnas Hasheva Shnas Hashmita. The year of the seven is coming close. The year of Shmita. There is an extraneous word over here because Imashu Shnemar Korva Shnas Hasheva Eni Odeshi Shnas Shmita. By virtue of the Torah telling me the seventh year is coming, I know the seventh year in a Shemitah cycle is the Shemitah year. So obviously, the Torah doesn't tell us extra things. By the fact the Torah had to say the same thing essentially twice means it's coming to tell us something. It's coming to teach us something I would not have known otherwise. And what is that? Elamatam lomar shnas hashmitah. What's this extra word shnas hashmitah coming to tell us? Lomar loch yesh shmita acheres shehi kazu. There's another law that resembles shmita. Beizazu, and what law is this that resembles shmita? Hamalva eschaver stam shein rashay letovo bepachos mishloshim yom. That if I lend to you, I am not allowed to collect for 30 days. So it's similar in the sense, it's not the same. You see, when shmita comes, it's mevatel, it cancels the loan altogether. So I'm never allowed to ask the lova for the money back. But we learn kind of like a pseudo shmita that when I loan money to you, I'm not allowed to collect it before 30 days are up. There's like this pseudo lo yigos that also there's like this little shmita that I'm not allowed to collect the money from you until 30 days are up. To Amar Mar, now where do we get 30? Shloshim yom b'shana chashiv shana. That 30 days is considered like a year. And now, where is that? So it's not in Rashi. It's actually very. What was that, Henry?
or a law, another where if it's just 30 days, you start counting the next year after 30 days.
Right? Excellent. All right. Yasher Koach, Henry. So as Henry pointed out, this is a reference to the principle of Arla. Arla is you plant a new tree for the first 3 years, you cannot benefit from it. But in the fourth year, you have Neta Revai. And those who were in our Sunday morning Chumash class, we've been dealing with agricultural laws for a little bit at the beginning of Kisavo. So you might recall, we talked about something called Neta Revai, that you bring it to the Beis HaMikdash. It's kind of like Maaser Sheni in similar ways, and you eat it in Yerushalayim. So the question is, it doesn't go like a year in terms of 12 months, then another 12 months, another 12 months. The question is what year the Arla is in, this tree is in. So if the tree was around for just 30 days before the beginning of next year, then that tree is considered from the previous year. And so by being planted for only 30 days, it already has been considered to have been planted for an entire year. And there is our tie-in to Tu B'Shvat right there. So what do you make of that, right? There you go. There's our tie-in to Tu B'Shvat. I didn't even intend it. Hashgacha Pratis. So there you go. We got the whole laws of the trees right there. Okay, wonderful. And that's important, by the way, because again, Tu B'Shvat has all these important halachas about where we draw the years for agriculture, for trees. And it's not just about eating dried fruit from Israel. You know, that's a nice thing also. I mean, I still have my... Don't is Mitch Bell with us here? Oh, Mitch, you're right here. I still need to eat the carrot that you gave us. It's in the kitchen. We apparently need to cook it. We can't just eat it plain, I realize. Otherwise you break your teeth. Is that right, Mitch? Right. Oh, you're muted.
Just eat it.
What was that? I thought I had to cook it or something.
Break it into a piece, put it in your mouth, and let it sit there for a while.
Okay, it's right there. I can still be Yotze the Mitzvah, right? Okay, I'll do it. All right, right after this meeting, I'm going to take a bite out of it. It's been on my kitchen table the whole day.
Don't bite it. Break it.
Break it. Okay, I got it. So yeah, I should call it to Mitchell Bell. That's why if you come back to shul, you get all these nice little treats that you wouldn't get otherwise. So yeah, I should call Mitch on bringing that for us. Okay. Now, here is this is wonderful. This next sugya we're going to look at, it's so short, but there's so much halachic literature just on these few little lines of Gemara that we're about to look at. You ever wonder, everyone ever hear of this whole machlokes about opening up a soda can or opening up a seltzer bottle on Shabbos? Does anyone ever hear of possibly... it might be problematic.
There was a discussion about seltzer, if you can put bubbles into water on Shabbos.
Okay, well, that's a separate issue, okay? But let's not even very good. So what Henry points out is that Rashi says a tikkun kli. So there's a whole issue. Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva on it, and it's, by the way, docketed as a future Monday night class, God willing. So we're not going to delve into it so much right now, but God willing, in our contemporary halakhic issues, we'll delve into it in the future. So I personally, what I do on Shabbos is I will open up a bottle of seltzer on Shabbos, but when it comes to a can, I will actually open it, but I'll immediately pour the contents out into a cup rather than drinking directly from the can. Now, what is the issue with the can? That's what we're going to look at right now. We're not going to have enough time to go into a whole tangent on it, but I want to bring to your attention why some people will not open up cans on Shabbos, but they'll open up soda bottles or seltzer bottles on Shabbos. It's all contained in these few lines of Gemara right here. So let's take
a look. Tell me where we are.
We are on the second of the widest lines. We are four lines up.
I don't see that. I'm on Safaria.
You're on Safaria. So it's toward the end. V'amarav Yehuda Amarav. If you search your words, Beis Hatzavar, then you'll find it. All right. But we're basically at the bottom section of the page, so somewhere in that area.
It's 4B.
I don't know. I don't have an article in front of me. Who has an article?
3B.
Right, 3B. Three. Well, yes, 3B.
Got the 4A.
We're going to get the 4A. Don't worry. That's the plan.
It's number 15.
I don't see number. Oh, I see. Yeah. There are numbers, right?
All right.
Thank you.
Great. So let's go forward. Amarav, Yehuda Amarav. So a number of these Gemaras now are going to seem to be out of place. And the truth is they are out of place. But the idea is that we just had a statement by Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav earlier. So now we're just going to share a few miscellaneous teachings of him, which they have nothing to do with Enim Zomim or Makos or anything we've been learning until now. But it's a really great way just to broaden our horizons. And, well, if the Gemara brings it up, we're going to learn it. So
what's the connection? I'm sorry, did you say?
The connection is that the same rabbi who just weighed in on the last discussion also happens to teach some other great Torah ideas. And the Gemara thought that this was an appropriate place to bring that in.
Okay.
So there's no topical connection, just the same rabbi.
Okay.
V'amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Haposeach Beis HaTzaver B'Shabbos Chayiv Chatas. If I open up, I have a shirt, and then I decide I open up, I make a hole so I could put my head through, I could put my arm through, and I complete that shirt on Shabbos, I'm Chayiv Chatas. I violated a prohibition of Tikkun Kli, of creating a garment which was not previously ready to be used prior to Shabbos.
Moshe, is it creating a garment or is it completing a garment?
Okay, very good. So let's, this is a Machlokes Rishonim. So as you can see in Rashi, Rashi assumes that the prohibition is, it sounds like Makeh B'Patish, which is completing something. Makeh B'Patish is, you know, kind of like, I guess, nail in the coffin, the last hit of the hammer, when it completes something, if you complete something on Shabbos, that something was not ready for use before Shabbos, and you complete it on Shabbos, that's Makeh B'Patish. That's one of the 39 Malachos. That's one of the prohibitions on Shabbos. That's what Rashi and Ramban and others think that you have violated. However, there are some who think, now I would say maybe the prohibition is Korea. The issue here is that I'm tearing on Shabbos. By tearing a hole in this garment so I could put my limbs, I could put my head through there, based on Tzavar, it's neck, so I could put my head through there and wear it as a shirt, I would think the Isser, the prohibition is Korea, is tearing material on Shabbos. So it's really contingent on how one defines the prohibition of Korea, of tearing on Shabbos. So according to some Rishonim, Rashi would be one of them. Korea is only prohibited amenas litvor, if you tear a garment a little bit so that you could then go ahead and stitch it up and in order to sew it in and fit it in properly. However, so therefore, over here, I'm only tearing. I'm not doing it with the intention of then sewing it and stitching it afterwards. So according to some Rishonim, this can't be a violation of Korea. Therefore, it's Makeh B'Patish. Therefore, it's just I'm completing something. It's not an issue of tearing something. But according to other Rishonim, primarily this is attributed to the Rambam. He says, Shekol Kriya Sheishba Tikkun Chayav Mela Mishum Korea. As long as you are doing the Korea, the tearing, for a productive purpose, that is problematic. The productive purpose sometimes is you tear something in order to stitch it and fit it to someone's size properly. Or over here, you don't need to stitch it. It's a productive thing to tear the garment simply just so you can put your head through the neckline there.
But does it matter? Isn't it an av malacha in any case?
In any case, you are correct. I just thought it was interesting to share the rationale behind this. And what you see from here is that the Rishonim, who do not want to say that this is an Isser of Korea, have a different definition of Korea. They think Korea is very limited in scope. You only violate the biblical prohibition if it's amanas litvor, if it's on condition to stitch. The other Rishonim would say it is Korea. What we see from here is that there's a broader understanding of Korea. Any Korea which serves a productive end is a biblical level violation, as opposed to a rabbinical level violation of just mekalkel. And this is important for Hilchos Shabbos, because when I tear open, I want to eat my dipsy doodle potato chips on Shabbos. That's what I always associate with Shabbos as a kid. It was like just a power of food that was hanging around the house I could have after the meal. Well, I was reading the Wall Street Journal when I was in high school. So I always have fond memories in my house after meal, eating dipsy doodles and reading the Wall Street Journal on the Shabbos afternoon. So why can I tear open that dipsy doodle bag on Shabbos? Because it's not a productive action. It's mekalkel. It's destroying the bag. And to access food, one is able to destroy the bag which is holding it. But actually what many people will do is they'll tear the bag open in a destructive manner. They'll actually tear open the bag and they'll put the ditzy doodles in a bowl or on a plate. That way they're not creating a kli on Shabbos, not creating a new vessel. Because until this point, the bag was not accessible. Now you're making it accessible and you can benefit from it on Shabbos. So there's so much halakha to get into right over here, but we have one more sugya to do. So God willing, you hold me to it. We have a few Scholar in Residence programs coming up on Monday night, so that puts me a little bit behind our schedule of Shirim. But God willing, you'll hold me to it. This hopefully will be a future class on Monday nights. So you'll remind me if it's something that the crowd desires. Okay, now the thing is, Maskifla Rav Kahana, back into the Gemara, Rav Kahana says, oh, there's a contradiction. Wait a minute. You're telling me I can't? It's a biblical prohibition to tear open the neckline so someone could wear the shirt on Shabbos. But isn't the halacha that if I have a keg, keg of beer, and there is the lid is sealed on top of it, I am allowed to open it on Shabbos. So what makes the Magufas Chavis, what makes this beer keg that I want to break open the lid on Shabbos different than tearing open an opening for my neck and head to go through the shirt on Shabbos? So the Gemara gives a very vague answer, and there's a lot of literature on this, but we'll just suffice with the basic understanding. Amar lei zeh chibur v'zeh eino chibur. One is considered connected, one is not considered connected. The shirt was sewn in before, it was completely connected, and you made a hole in it, but the keg of beer, that the lid already was a separate entity from the rest of the keg. But it was sealed in. You put a little bit of pitch over there as an adhesive to keep it down so the liquid wouldn't come out. So when you break open that lid, the lid is already a separate entity from the keg. You did not separate the lid proper from the keg to the point that it's considered creating a new object. And that is really, by the way, the basis for why opening up a bottle on Shabbos is different than opening up a can, because the cap and the bottle are two separate entities already. I'm just making a little break to get that cap off. Whereas when it comes to a can, it's a little harder to be mater to permit that on Shabbos, because the can is just one entity. And by me opening it up, I now make it a usable kli, a usable vessel for me to drink from on Shabbos. So that's, again, we can elaborate on for a while, but at least we come out with an understanding, halacha lemaisa, why some people have issues with opening up bottles. I don't think there's an issue, but cans, you certainly enter questions. So that's personally what I do, is I will open the can and immediately pour the contents out. So that's what, and that way it doesn't create a kli on.
You're talking about a modern soda can where you pull a tab and it opens up? Well, you're talking about,
that would be similar to the soda bottle also. It's the same. That's even better, actually. I mean, there's nothing really connecting it. It's just pressed down with pressure. So then you, like a beer bottle, right?
So you pull it up.
Talking about like a beer bottle, right? And it's even better than Magufas Chavetz, because there's not even an adhesive. It just pushed down onto it. So there's certainly no prohibition of opening that up on Shabbos, as far as I know. I'm sure you know, the principle in halacha is you can always find someone who's machmir. It's not that hard. You can always find someone who will be machmir and say you can't do something. But it seems to me that there's no reason to prohibit that on Shabbos based on this. Okay. Well, we'll schedule maybe for the next round of halachas for Pini Halacha. How about that? Okay. One more sugya we're going to do. And, God willing, if it's a little unclear this time, then we will try to rehash it at the beginning of next time. Is mikvos. Let me give a really brief background to mikvos. I cannot do this adequately in a few minutes. But essentially, a mikvah has to have 40 sa'ah. Offhand, I'm forgetting exactly how much in fluid ounces that is, but you go to the mikvah in our shul, it has more than 40 sa'ah. If you've ever seen it, beautiful mikvah that we have, it's has more than 40 sa'ah of water in there. Now, here's the thing. Once a mikvah has the requisite amount of water in there, there's a rivet, whatever that's machmir, but essentially, once a mikvah is a kosher mikvah, it cannot lose its status as a kosher mikvah. So if I pour, now what could invalidate a mikvah? Mayim she'uvin. A mikvah should be rainwater. If I put water in a vessel, meaning literally drawn water, and I put it in, and I put it in a mikvah, that in theory can invalidate a mikvah when it's first being made. But if a mikvah is already at 40 sa'ah, then everything is okay. We don't have to worry about it. And that's why if you go to a mikvah, you'll see there's a bor hashaka, a bor hazria. We have backup mikvos, which when we want to clean out our mikvah, we always have 40 sa'ah of water, which ensures the integrity, ensures the kosher status of the water there. Again, something else for a whole entire shiur. That was a fun fact. That was like the last bechina, the last test I took in Wayu Smicha before coming here. So it's a little fresh in my mind. Now here's the thing. Let's say I haven't reached 40 sa'ah yet, and I put 3 lugin of water. I don't have the exact amount, but if anyone wants to do a math, a revia salug is somewhere between like 3 and 4 fluid ounces, I believe. And that's a revia, that's a fourth of a lug. So multiply that by 4, and then times 3, and then you'll get the number. So whoever does the math, you'll let me know. So when you have 3 lugin of that water, still not a huge amount of water, by the way, compared to 40 sa, very small. But you have 3 lugin of invalid mayim shuvim, of drawn water, and that goes into the mikvah before it reaches the requisite amount, the whole mikvah is no longer considered kosher. So that's an important idea to know going into this Gemara. Now, based on that, let's start the Gemara. V'amar Rav Yehuda Amaram, Shloshes lugin mayim shenafal asochan kortav shel yayin, umar ein kemar yayin, v'nafal mikvah, lo pasluhu. Let's say I have 3 lugin of water that by all rights, it's mayim she'uvin, that would invalidate the kosher status of this mikvah. But then a kortav, a very small amount of wine, falls in that water, and it gives the water the appearance of wine. That water no longer will invalidate the mikvah because the water is no longer viewed as water. It's now diluted wine. And wine, it won't be added to the mikvah when we're counting 40 sa'ah, but it won't invalidate the mikvah either. Maskiv la Rav Kahana, b'chima bin zeh l'meitzeva, d'tnan, Rabbi Yossi Omer, meitzeva posted as a mikvah, l'shol shaslugin. Well, how is wine with water any different than water, colored water, which still invalidates a mikvah? So the difference is, Amar le Rav, hasam mai meitzeva mikri, hachachamra maziga mikri. Because there, it's in the name. It's in the name. You know, it's you'll forgive me. I'm not taking a political side, but it's almost like there's like this Ben Shapiro thing one time where someone asked, "How do you know Boy Scouts is only for boys?" He said, "It's in the name, Boy Scouts." So Havdal Alpe Havdalos, not no connection to that, but just the principle. So how do I know that that one thing is cold wine, the other thing is cold water? So one is called colored water, the other one is called diluted wine. So colored water still has a status of water and can invalidate the mikvah, but something which is regarded as diluted wine, that's not called water anymore, it's called wine, that is not problematic and will not invalidate the mikvah. That's the principle there. So we're just going to begin moving on to the next amud just to start this sugya, but I don't think we'll finish it. So we might just end in the middle of something so we can end on time. But just only if there's a clarification that I can make. Is there anything I can do just to clarify what we just said? Okay. I'm glad that was clear. Hopefully my example only added and didn't detract. Okay. The Hisli Rabbi Chiya Horidu Es HaMikvah. But Rabbi Chiya, he declared that such a mikvah with the water with the appearance of wine, actually it invalidates a mikvah. He disagrees with Rabbi Yehuda Amarav, with our entire premise. Amarava, so wait a minute, what's the substance of their disagreement? Lo kasha, ha Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, ha Rabbanan. Well, actually their disagreement is really, we could trace it back to a Mishnah. This isn't just an Amoraic disagreement. This disagreement took place at least 300 or so years earlier, back in the times of the Mishnah. And where can we trace this back in the Mishnayos? Ditznan shloshes lugin mayim choser korta. By the way, this is an important detail. Before, we were talking about 3 lugin of water. enough to invalidate a mikvah, plus wine I was added on. But here, let's say I have 3 lugin of water minus a kurta. Doesn't have enough to make it on its own. Shnavo sochan kurta v'yayin, umarein kamari yayin, that then a kurta of wine fell in to that, you know, let's say it was like 2.999 lugin of water, v'nafla mikvah, and then that went into the mikvah, that mixture, lo paslu, that would not invalidate the mikvah. Same thing. You have 2.9 or so lugin of water, and then a quart of milk goes in. That also will not invalidate the mikvah. What's the inference we can make? The inference is that according to the Chachamim, according to the Rabbanan, the majority opinion, if there was in fact 3 lugin of water on its own, without the wine, without the milk, regardless of whether that drop of wine is put in and changes the appearance of the mixture, it will invalidate the mikvah. This supports the opinion of Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, the next opinion, Omer, hakol holich achar hamara. Also important to underline there. Everything is not contingent on the amount, but it's contingent on the appearance of this liquid solution. If this liquid solution now looks like wine, then it is wine. And it doesn't matter if there's 3 lugin of water in there, it will not invalidate the mikvah. So it would seem that Rabbi Yehuda Marav, who says 3 lugin of water plus a quart of wine, it doesn't invalidate the mikvah, he only fits with the opinion of Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, but he does not fit, he disagrees with the opinion of the Chachamim. He is not in line with the opinion of the Chachamim, who say that the amount of water is more important than the appearance of the water. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says, the appearance is more important than the amount of water in there. So when you have a solution, you have enough water to invalidate the mikvah on its own, but then you add wine in, on the one hand, there's enough water to invalidate the mikvah. That's opinion number one. But on the other hand, there's wine there and that turns into diluted wine, which does not have the potential, the potency to invalidate the mikvah. That is one presentation of this machlokas. But we are at the end of our time. So God willing, what we'll do is next time, we'll just quickly rehash what we did in this past 10 minutes. And then we will finish this sogia, God willing, next time when we meet next week as well. So Yasher Koach, everyone. It's 8:30, so anyone who needs to log off, please feel welcome to log off. But I understand I'm leaving on a cliffhanger, so I'm going to remain on for another few minutes if there are any questions that I can take to help clarify what we just learned and anything that we learned during the session.
Koach, everybody.
Shkoyach.
I'm hanging in.
Good Shabbos, everybody.
Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you. Good Shabbos.
Rabbi.
All right. Shabbos.
Talking about wine, yes. I assume that they had in mind red wine. What about white wine?
So white wine would probably be similar to milk. So we didn't elaborate so much on it, but when it comes to milk, even Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri would agree. Actually, he says that the milk would be mashlim. Rashi says, havu mashlimu chalav, that the milk will, if the milk is able to bring that water to 3 lugin, the milk will be considered like water because it dissipates. And it basically has the same color because the whiteness will dissipate in the water when there's enough water and very little milk. So I think white wine would probably be similar to milk in that not only will it not help our cause, but actually it will serve to our detriment because it'll combine with the water, it'll reach the requisite gimel lugin and invalidate the mikvah. Does that answer your question?
I'll sit here and scratch my head for a while.
Well, the good news is next week we're actually going to start the session by completely rehashing this because I realized that I gave a very quick introduction because I noticed I always do this. I apologize. We had 10 minutes left. But the beginning of next session, we'll really nail down all of these halachos. So even if we didn't get the last few minutes, this last little sugya, that's what we're opening up with. So we will definitely, I'll endeavor to provide a more expansive introduction to the topic. All right. Oh, I see someone in the chat. Howard, what does Old Sav do in Makos? The answer is Howard has absolutely nothing to do with Makos. But there was a rabbi who weighed in on the halacha that was relevant beforehand, which was Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Rav Yehuda name of Rav. And the Gemara said, you know what? This rabbi has a few other important halachas for us to learn. So now is a good time to share it as any, apparently. But it makes us more knowledgeable of halacha in general, not just the laws of Ein and Zomen. Okay. Oh, and I see Phyllis said he said before nothing. Okay. Yes.
I'll drink to that.
All right. Yasher Koach, everyone. Any other questions or all right. Have a wonderful Shabbos and looking forward to learning together next week as well. Have a good night, Zadie, Gloria, Arlene, Howard, and Melissa.
Good night.